Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. It was 1 week ago today, actually, on the morning show that we talked on the morning show for our monthly United Environmental Council feature about the process of pollination and what an essential role that process plays in the well-being of our environment, and in certainly the growth of green things all around us. I mean, we as a human race would really be sunk were it not for pollination. And of course, I'm sure many of you are aware of the fact that there is escalating concern about the declining number of bees, especially plain old lovely honeybees in the world. And it makes the work of beekeepers, whether amateur or professionals, even more important in this day and age. So I'm really excited for this particular edition of the morning show to return to this topic with two local guests who are both officers with the Racine Kenosha Beekeepers Association. We have with us in the studio Peter Poli, who is the president, and we have Tim Fulton, who is past president of the organization. And one of them is a relative newcomer to beekeeping. The other has been doing it for a long, long time. We're going to find out why they have engaged in this activity, what kind of pleasure it gives them, how many times they've been stung. I mean, what kind of a complicated undertaking this is. Is it expensive? The reasons why they hope maybe you will think about also doing some beekeeping of your own. It's a great topic, and I'm excited that we can do this today. So Peter Poli and Tim Fulton, we welcome both of you to the morning show. We're so glad you're here.
Very happy to be here.
Thank you.
Good to have you. And Tim, if you'll pull that just a little bit closer, you didn't realize that had wandered off from you. One more time. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Thanks. All right. And Tim Fulton, you are actually the past president of the organization, but you also happen to be the real veteran of beekeeping. You've been doing it for a long, long time. So let's find out a little bit about how you got involved in this. I mean, where were you living at the time, and what prompted you to undertake beekeeping?
Well, I grew up in western Colorado, the Grand Valley. And there was lots of pollination going on, a lot of peach orchards and alfalfa for seed, as well as for hay. And my family were ranchers and farmers, and there was a beekeeper, Mr. Saunders, had bees on the place, and so I was very curious about bees, about bugs in general, and kind of followed him around, and he showed me through his operation. That was back when I was in grade school, elementary school.
And then, so a ways back.
Way back, right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And was he a, I mean, and I'm not sure how much this distinction even makes sense in your business, but was he a professional beekeeper or strictly an amateur?
Absolutely. No, he was, I guess we would indicate that he was a honey producer with a sideline for pollination. Pollination really didn't get a start in this country until the 80s, early 80s.
You mean thinking about
really
pollination?
Where that pollination became the primary income for commercial beekeepers.
Right. So in other words, it's not just about the honey they produce, but in many cases, bees are brought in to, in a sense, facilitate pollination or make sure that it occurs
absolutely
to the
yes
level that it needs to.
That's right.
So as a youngster, you were already intrigued by bees.
Absolutely.
At what point did you first attempt to do some beekeeping of your own? Were you still a youngster, so to speak, or did you wait till you were an adult?
Not at all. No, I moved on to other things. Went to school and became a speech therapist and went way away from it. Moved to Iowa, and met a family there, and they had been, you know, just had a few hives and talked about a little bit. Ended up marrying into the family.
Into this family of beekeepers?
Family of farmers, actually. Ah, mm-hmm. Farmers. And moved to Kenosha, Wisconsin for a job. And finally was able to move out of town and a little bit of acreage. And neighbor and I got into it together and started a couple of hives and kind of went from there.
Okay, so it sounds like that's where your most serious beekeeping began then,
exactly.
Was once you moved here.
Once I moved here, yes.
And how long ago was that?
That was about 20 years ago.
Okay. So you certainly know something about this by now. So from Western Colorado to Wyoming, Iowa,
right.
To Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Exactly.
And yes. Each of those places you've called home have played some role in this evolving interest of yours.
Right.
Very good. What about you, Peter Pulley? You are the current president, but you have not been beekeeping quite so long as Tim Fulton.
That's correct. I took my interest, would have been around 2009, and it mostly was due to hearing that the bees were in peril. And I thought, well, what could I do? I did some research and found that one of the thought processes was to increase the number of independently managed hives. And so there was a promotion for people to get into beekeeping or a push for such. And I decided that I'd give it a shot. And I had some wood in the garage, and I found some plans, and I started cutting and building and making. And my lovely wife, what are you doing? Oh, nothing. And so then it's as many of my hobbies that come along. She originally wasn't so sure it was the best idea, but then soon came to also enjoy the bees very much herself. And since then, mostly there's a couple different types of beekeepers out there, not only migratory honey producers, but then there's people who are sideliners who maybe have a regular day job and then decide to take their spare time and go and spend it all doing beekeeping, and then there's hobbyists, and then inside of the hobbyists there's different types of beekeeping when it comes to traditional Langstroth keeping, keeping bees in top bar hives, and some different concepts out there. So some of the alternative stuff interested me, and that's I do all the different types of beekeeping for the most part. So I have four different types of hives that I run. And so my thing is just playing, having fun, and if I have some extra honey and wax and make some candles and a few products and sell them to some friends or whatever, it's all good.
There you go. Tim Fulton, are you also a dabbler into the different kinds of bee, or are you focused on one particular type of hive?
I've stayed with the, what Peter mentioned, the Langstroth hive, which was invented back in around 1850. It's a movable frame hive, so you can open the hive up with minimal disturbance of the bees. You can also separate it out and extract honey without, again, major disturbance. They also seem to overwinter a little better than some of the other experimental ones. That's arguable, I guess. But so yeah, it's
that's kind of where
I am.
And if we have seen hives, is it most likely that we've seen the type that you use? I mean, are they the most commonly used?
The square boxes that are stacked on top of each other, exactly.
Right. Yep. So nothing fancy to look at, but it sounds like they really do the job.
That's correct.
Peter, tell us a little bit about this organization, which the two of you are part of, that you are the president of and that Tim Fulton is the past president of, the Racine-Kenosha Beekeepers Association. First of all, how big an organization is this, and what are the most important activities which you undertake?
Excellent, absolutely. So for the most part, we get together approximately once a month. There's a couple times a year that we do not convene. It's always the first Wednesday of each month, and for the most part, we meet at the Kenosha County Building at Highway 50 and 45, and so we meet 7 to 9 p.m., and it's mostly, I would call it, a coming together of interested beekeepers. There certainly are beekeepers who are not part of our club. They're within our area, if you will, in Racine and Kenosha counties. But I'd say roughly at any given meeting, there's 40 to 60 people at a meeting, and being the first Wednesday of the month, September 2nd would be our next meeting, and we are a very expensive club to belong to. We charge an entire $5 a year for membership. So we don't really currently offer a payment plan, but but at the $5, I like to tell people that we have cookies and coffee and juice, and by the second or third meeting, I feel like I'm money ahead.
Right, no kidding. Especially if you like those cookies.
Absolutely.
This was a serious step up. It's back when I started, the $5 was assessed if you didn't come to the Christmas party.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, it was waived. So.
Very good. And how long has the organization been around? I mean, for instance, Tim, as long as you've been beekeeping in the area, which is 20 years, has this organization existed, or is it newer than that?
I would say older than that, yes, by quite a bit. I'm not...
I could be slightly mistaken, but when I was going through, I just recently took the presidency back in February, was going through some of the archives, and I could be mistaken, but I think it's approximately 1930s that the Racine Kenosha beekeepers go back to.
Wow. Very good.
Just as a piece of insight, there, the first beekeeping organization, which was back in the 1850s, one of the first presidents was from Kenosha.
Oh.
And if you can imagine going to Madison – in 1850.
Wow.
For a meeting about bees. That's pretty spectacular.
I guess so. For those of you just joining us, we're talking today with Peter Poley and Tim Fulton, president and past president, respectively, of the Racine Kenosha Beekeepers Association. And we are going to be talking in a little more detail now about this this hobby for both of them, which gives them great pleasure, they and others who are part of this association. And of course, they are engaged in beekeeping at a time when really, for the most part, the story of bees is an alarming one. That is, the number of honeybees that seem to be out in the wild, so to speak, those numbers seem to be just drastically plummeting. And I can't say that I've actually read up on this topic very recently to know if recent efforts to sort of stem that decline, if those efforts have made much of a difference, or are we still seeing these numbers sort of going down as alarmingly as they have been?
I'd say recently there's been some polls and reports that we might be on a leveling off point. However, there's some articles that argue that being that the leveling off is actually due to the increased interest in beekeeping. So if the determining factor is total number of colonies at a current time, and new beekeepers have come in, and many people are having issues with their hives, be it new as well as seasoned beekeepers, then those numbers might be skewed, and we actually still might be experiencing a downward trend, just more people diluting the numbers a little bit.
Right.
So,
in other words, the problem, whatever it might be, or perhaps a cluster of issues that are leading to this decline, those problems might still be in place as much as ever. But at least these efforts to increase the number of beekeepers out there are boosting the total numbers, which I suppose that's not an insignificant thing, but it's not in a sense the cure of the problem, whatever the problem is. In fact, what is our understanding of what is causing this? I mean, are there particular theories that are particularly prevalent?
Well, your comment alluding to an array of problems is right on. It's refreshing to hear someone say that. Nutrition is an issue for bees as well as some of the native bees, in that particularly in the farm areas where big farms are maximizing their profit by allowing only, let's say, corn and beans to exist, that's an ecological desert for pollinators, be it bees, butterflies, or whatever. So that's one issue. The insecticides that are being used now, they're a systemic insecticide that goes on seed coat, goes up into the plant. It's commonly referred to as a family of insecticides called neonicotinoids. There's been certainly argument back and forth of whether it's lethal or sublethal or whatever. It does, in fact, have an impact on pollinators. And then different pathogens have been introduced to our bees over time, and that has seriously impacted longevity of bees to the point where arguably honeybees are no longer sustainable. That is to say, if bees were to end up in a hollow tree somewhere, their chances of survival are slim. Hmm. In other words, honeybees need to be managed now with chemicals to control some of the pathogens.
Wow. So in other words, the work of beekeepers is even more essential than it ever was. Is that part of what you're saying?
Yes. The conversation now is leaning toward let's not put all the emphasis on honeybees, but rather try to sustain the native bees that weren't. Honeybee is an imported insect from Europe. It's not a native.
Eurasian honeybee.
Eurasian honeybee.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. So the bumblebees and all the other solitary bees. That being said, they still can't survive in that ecological desert. That's a cornfield and a beanfield. So even if we were to try and rely upon them, it's still going to be an issue.
Right.
So that's in the works. There's money being put forward by Department of Ag to encourage pollinator strips, but that's going to be up the road.
And what does that term refer to?
Pollinator strip would be in lieu of corn and beans or some other monocrop like that. You would plant a variety of plants that would produce flowers
pollen producing.
Oh, I see. And so, for instance, in the middle of an otherwise verdant field of corn or whatever, there would be a strip, and that would be cultivated for the sole purpose or the primary purpose of providing nutrition for bees.
Exactly. And butterflies.
Pollinator habitat, for everything. That's actually on my list of some of the things that probably many of your listeners are in the residential category. And people say, well, what is it that I can do at home to help make things better for honeybees? And I think it's taking a good look at how we use our property, what we think is a proper lawn. This is going to take some time, but mines are changing. An emerald green lawn with no weeds is again, not too far of what Tim described as being something that's completely not anything beneficial for any of the pollinators. So if you can, like I at my house have taken a corner of my yard and over the course of a few years kind of been converting it over back to native prairie. It's not very big. It's maybe the size of a two-car garage, if maybe a car and a half. And since I've done that, I've just seen so many more bugs and butterflies and birds, and it's just really changed the aspect of my backyard. Also, these areas, as you may already well be aware, have the ability to retain up to an inch of rainfall prior to allowing runoff. So there's additional benefits available to doing these kinds of things, not just in a farming aspect, in a residential aspect. People not using pesticides on, say, their flower garden. Now, I understand people wanting to have beautiful flowers, and I completely respect that. And if people can't find their way to find a way to refrain from using them during the day and move to evening when the bees are roosting, if you will, back at the hive. And so if the label doesn't recommend spraying in the evening, give that a shot and get the benefits that they want. It'll be dry by morning typically and not be something the bees would visit and take back to the hive. It's maybe, I don't know if it's a good medium, but it's better than the morning application. So those are definitely some things. Sometimes people say, well, I've heard if I become a beekeeper, it'll help the bees. That's exactly what originally drew me to beekeeping. And honestly, everything that I've gone through, I'm happy where I'm at as a beekeeper. However, I do encounter a lot of people who think that this is something you can just decide the night before and the next morning go buy what you need. There's many places now that stock the stuff on the shelves at different farm supply stores, and then you order your bees and they show up. But it really takes dedication, and I think that that's a key thing. So if people say, well, I don't really have that many extra hours a week throughout the entire season, short of winter, to take on and the responsibility, then they should focus on their property and maybe their friend's property and communal property, and do some improvements for pollinator habitat and help a broad spectrum of insects.
That might be just as helpful as anything, and particularly better than plunging into this without really knowing what you're doing. That's a very good point. I'm curious about where each of you live, and I guess even more broadly beyond that, when we look at all these people that belong to your organization. I mean, like, for instance, Peter, you told me you grew up in the heart of Chicago.
Right.
And you weren't raising bees then, I would wager. I mean, do you live now in – wait, you live in – oh, you live in Wilmot?
In Wilmot, Wisconsin, that's
right.
Correct.
And do you live right there in town, or are you in –
I do. I live right in Wilmot, Wisconsin, and I do have some bees for the first time this year right at my residence, and I definitely enjoy having them there. I also keep bees on a parcel about a couple miles away from my home. I have another apiary set up at that location, so for what it's worth, it can be done in an urban setting. There's also locations, like, for example, you can keep bees in Chicago, rooftop beekeeping. There's bees at O'Hare Airport. There are bees. Madison has a balcony ordinance, or at least did the last time that I checked. In France, rooftop beekeeping throughout parts of Europe. So right downtown city centers. There really aren't many places you couldn't keep bees. They travel 2 to 5 miles in all directions of the hive to gather the things that they need. So for the most part, I would say there really isn't any location you couldn't do it. If people feel restricted as to, well, I don't think I'll be able to do it where I'm at, how I started originally was putting up some ads at some feed stores saying, looking for agricultural property to place my hives. And I have to say, my phone rang off the hook.
Wow.
There's plenty of people who would like to have hives but don't have the time or the abilities and are willing to make their property available. And these relationships are very easy to establish.
Wow. And that's a win-win. And I suppose you're not even asked to pay anything, I'm guessing.
Typically, the unwritten rule, if you will, or the suggested rent payment for keeping your hive on somebody's piece of property is maybe a quart of honey annually from the hive. And say, for every hive, you provide a quart of honey.
There you go. How about you, Tim Fulton? You live in Summers.
In Summers, yes. I live in a, I guess it would be categorized as a low-density urban setting. We have 2 acres, and we placed an acre and a half into native prairie. Hmm. One has been established probably close to 20 years. The other one's a little bit newer, but as Peter says, it's an amazing environment. You start seeing all kinds of pollinator insects showing up. We're now a monarch butterfly station, so we observe that. And as far as water conservation, it's amazing. I mean, I see, you know, frogs. Even now, where it's very dry, our neighbors' lawns are turning brown, and this is just, you know, very green, very beautiful.
Smartest thing could possibly do. We're speaking with Peter Poley and Tim Fulton, who are both with the Racine Kenosha Beekeepers Association, talking about this this hobby, this undertaking, which gives them and their fellow members of the Beekeeping Association great pleasure and satisfaction. So I think we haven't yet talked enough about what beekeeping actually represents. And Peter, you touched on the fact that it's a lot of work and you really need to go into this kind of knowing what you're doing. On the surface, it seems pretty simple. It seems a little bit like just putting a birdhouse up in your backyard. And if birds come and build a nest in it, well, that's great. And if they don't, they don't. But I suspect we're talking about something much more involved. Typically, when somebody begins this, what is the first thing that happens? Do the hives themselves get constructed? Do you purchase them from some place? Or in your case, you kind of, I think, maybe built them on your own. But is that step one?
Yes, absolutely. So step one would be to assemble, either purchase assembled, purchased unassembled that need assembly hives, to or build from scratch the gear that you need, also recognizing the time of the year. So if somebody says, you know, I just got done listening to this radio show and I think I'd like to be a beekeeper, well, they are a little late for 2015, actually a lot late. They would need to, but this would be a great time to dig in and learn everything that they can about beginning beekeeping. A book that our club constantly pushes and we sell at our club at discount is First Lessons in Beekeeping. And it's over a 100-year-old publication, originally put out by Dayton Publishing. And it's $10. You can find it on Amazon for, I think, like $9.99. Or you can show up at our club, become a member, and get a little discount and purchase the book and have a couple brownies. That would be reading something like that cover to cover. What I tell a lot of people is it's expensive to start beekeeping. So spend the $10, buy this book, read it from cover to cover. If you get to the back end of the book and you say, yeah, you know what, I think I still would like to do this, and then I say, well, why don't you go ahead and proceed then. If it seems like a little too much, a little too overwhelming, well, then maybe focus on pollinator habitat. But
and you probably saved a lot of money that would have gone down the drain in an ill-fated venture.
Absolutely.
If you'd gone into it blind without knowing anything.
Absolutely. And I think that that's an important thing to hit on here quickly is that people who take up beekeeping and then become overwhelmed and say they're maybe a bit hesitant to go into their hive or to dig in and learn the different aspects. When you have a hive that you're not managing and different pests can move in, for example, hive beetle, wax moth, and also varroa mite. And these things, if you leave them unchecked, what your hive then becomes is somewhat of an epicenter for these to breed. And then this can expand out to other hives where people are trying to actively manage them and make everybody's job much more difficult. So I definitely say if people are going to get into this, they have to say, I'm going to be covered in bees at some point. I'm going to get stung a few points. It could even be slightly intimidating. And if they should have a way to say, hey, if I don't decide to stay with this, who could I turn to and pass my gear and bees off to, or who can I turn to for some help? And that's where the Racine Kenosha beekeepers come in. We like people to come to our club, try and connect them with a mentor, connect them with places they can go for additional knowledge, information, and hopefully either keep them in the hobby or help them wherever they're at.
Excellent. Yeah,
I've talked a few people out of it, actually. Where they've said, you know, I really don't have a lot of time, and I'm not sure I want to get stung, etc. So, you know, that would be maybe one of the first things a person should do is come to a beekeeper's meeting, hook up with a mentor. Most of us have a couple of extra bee suits. Have somebody come out in a bee yard and see what it's like to get your hands into a hive, and. If you react by running and screaming, then maybe you should rethink.
Maybe it's not for you.
On the other hand, you know, as Peter said, it's getting more and more expensive all the time. We recommend two hives instead of just one, and we're probably looking at $1,000
easy, just
to start. And then if you're into it, then it goes up from there.
As you expand and so on. Peter, you mentioned that in addition to the standard white box that we see most often, you are dabbling in several other types of hives. Without getting into too much detail, I suppose, can you just sort of briefly describe kind of the difference? Is it just a difference in sort of shape, or is it are there more profound differences?
So I do Kenyan top bar beekeeping, which is somewhat popular in the might want to consider it people who believe they're going to get into natural beekeeping. And a Kenyan top bar, I tell people, well, it's a horizontal top bar, kind of looks like a manger, if you will. And sometimes bees move into walls and cavities of homes. I get a lot of calls about that and have done some removals. and the bees move in between the floor joists, and the way they line up in the floor joists is really not a whole lot different than a Kenyan top bar. So it is a manageable concept. Then I also do a Waray hive, which is a stacked top bar. And we say top bar, what that means is we just give them the top bar instead of a top bar, two wooden side bars, and a bottom bar like on the Langstroth system. So they build a curtain of comb. And so then the third one that I do, I just started doing, is a Perone hive, which is a South American system that I just started basically this season. And it's 2 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot. And the concept there, I'll recall it incorrectly, but it's kind of like the same concept as a Nautilus seashell, in that it's a perfect cube. And the bees, first season, you just let them build up that cube. And then the second season, you add these supers. The problem with top bar beekeeping, be it vertical or horizontal, is you can find people who build them. I mean, I happen to build and sell a few, but it's there's not as many products available to just go buy and say, here, buy this and stick it in your hive. You have to be a little crafty, or buy a complete system, and then the systems aren't necessarily compatible in Langstroth. Some people do 8-frame. Some people do 10-frame. I'm an 8-framer, so I don't even do Langstroth normal. I don't do really anything normal. But that's just in my wiring. Basically, with Langstroth, you can knock it down to a nuke, which is 5 frames. You can do deeps. There's people who do shallows. So even in the Langstroth keeping, the regular white box, there's probably an easy 6 to 8 different variations that you could get into and how you keep that style. So I think it's good to know that there's a lot of different flavors out there.
Right. Once you have a couple of hives built and ready to house bees, how do you get the bees? And once you have the bees, how do you get them in the hive? So, question one.
Several ways. I think the most popular way now is to order bees from a broker who sends them to you or brings them to the area by truck, generally from California or from down south. This would be in the spring. And essentially a screen box with a can of syrup to keep them fed and a queen in a separate box. And you just take those and you disassemble or take the top off, take the can out, shake them into your hive, put the queen in, and she's usually added to this group of bees, so you have to put her in separately release her later when they accommodate her. That's been traditionally the way. Or you can purchase what Peter mentioned, a nuke or a 5-frame small hive, and it's all ready to go. It's the queen is already laying eggs and producing young. And there's a little bit of honey in there, so you move that to your larger hive, and then you're ahead of the game. You're also ahead of the game as far as some of the diseases, some of the parasites. So you have to be ready to treat them right away, and go from there. So the management is a little bit different.
Right. Now, when it comes to those kind of problems, which you want to be, is it a matter of you yourself educating yourself to watch for the danger signs, or are there veterinarians you bring in to look at your bees? Or
we do have a state apiarist and a state inspector, and he's on call. He can come out usually in the spring and the fall to do inspections. But you really have to be your own manager. You have to learn the rhythm of the bees. You have to know what to look for when it's time to do certain tasks in the hive to increase it. You kind of have to learn how to let the bees tell you what they need. You have to do some testings to test some assessment testing to determine what diseases are there, and you need to know what array of treatments to use. So that there's a lot to learn.
When we're talking about doing this for the sake of pollination, which is, Peter, I think the reason you got into this in the first place, right?
Right. Well, for the sake of the bees and to try and do my part to help have pollinators in the area, which has then opened my eyes to so many more things of understanding. And beekeeping has led me to understanding that there's little blossoms on maple trees early in the spring, and they're green just like the leaves, and they give out their nectar, and that's an early source. Understanding different plants and what they mean to the bees, and there's many things that even from a community aspect, government, where maybe in the parkways they'll mow down maybe some great blue asters that are blooming right now, when those are actually, you know, another great source. The honeybees are hitting them, and I watch them then get mowed down. And though it's just a strip 10 feet wide along the edge of the road, be nice if maybe we could say that I don't find a bunch of blue flowers to be a problem to look at. I actually like them, knowing what they do for the environment.
Sure.
So that's something there.
When pollination is the primary reason that someone is doing this, does it in that towards that end, does it matter very much where your bees are, where your hives are, or do they end up kind of flying hither and yon? And so wherever they are, for instance, on your property, are they equally likely to be sort of serving the cause of pollination?
Yeah, to a degree. Now, if you're a let's say an apple producer, and you decided that you wanted bees for your apples, well, unless you're an organic apple grower, you're going to need to treat those apples from time to time with an insecticide. So an apple orchard is probably not the best place to keep bees. Mm. You need to move them in when they're needed during bloom, and then be able to move them out to a safe distance away from the application of insecticides.
Right.
So there's some cautions that need to do now.
So that would be the biggest reason to think about where you locate to locate them, not
yes,
immediately
yes.
adjacent to something that might be dangerous to
yeah.
them.
Yeah, I'm a member of, or I've signed on with a government program called Driftwatch, and we're on. I'm on a GPS map, and applicators need to check that before they go spray. So I'm involved in that, and so you know they need to watch the wind and hopefully use their application when the bees aren't flying, or at least be able to contact me and perhaps net my hives if that's an issue, whatever. So there are those issues rather than just let them fly.
Right.
Yep.
What about the issues of neighbors? I mean, does that come up very often? I mean, in terms of people that live, for instance, adjacent to your property, worrying about the fact that you're raising bees and perhaps creating something that could potentially be a hazard to somebody. And I don't even mean for the two of you personally, but more even your membership as a whole. How much is that an issue, and what is done? What can be done about that?
It is an issue because there are people who have maybe an inborn fear of anything that stings or whatever. So if you're going to have bees, I mean, there are two arguments. This is my property. If my township municipality allows beekeeping, then I can do with what I want. But what if my neighbor's child is allergic to insect stings to the point of
being anaphylactically allergic?
Well, that's something that you need to think about. There are other people who are just kind of adversarial.
Right.
In any sort of perceived threat to
sure. them. Sure, just get it in their heads that this is a problem or this
so,
is.
So you need to deal with that beforehand. I'm an advocate of knowing your neighbors, being open. There's an old adage, keep your fences high and your neighbor's honeypot full. Okay. Keep quiet. You know, don't
that's
tell
a,
anybody.
That's a beekeeper's motto, in other
that's
words.
That's an old beekeeper's motto. And it does work. I mean, you can hide your hives and nobody knows that they're there.
Mm.
You know, they're scattered out. They're out pollinating. They're
sure.
not bothering anybody. But
right.
So it is an issue.
Yeah. I think it's important to also know that there's these regulations ordinances when towns produce those, there are some things where there's best management practices for certain setbacks, flyway barriers, different things that can help keep the bees from intercepting, say, your neighbor on their property. For example, if you aimed your entrance at their property and didn't have a fence, well, in the flight path could easily go right over where they like to mow, and there could definitely be some kind of an occurrence.
Right.
So, you know, we wouldn't be breaking any new ground here. There's plenty of existing ordinances out there to look at and get great ideas. Madison has a great ordinance. I worked on a Lake County, Illinois ordinance last season for beekeeping chickens and hoop houses that went very well, and generally it's size specific. So I tell people first, okay, find out if you can keep bees where you're at, and then if you can keep bees, then you need to follow whatever the guidelines are, be it sign up for a permit or a free permit. Racine proper, the city of, has a great system. It's very simple to become a beekeeper in Racine, the city of, and you would follow those rules. And then along those lines, see what you need to do. Then approach your neighbors and say, hey, I'm going to keep bees. You think that would bother you? And then they're going to probably, most people, oh, I'm afraid of bees. You know, I'm allergic. Many people think they're allergic. But the saying is roughly 0.1% are truly to be allergic is to be anaphylactically allergic and have trouble breathing and need medical attention. Swelling up, if I get stung, I swell up, but that doesn't make me allergic. Mm. And so talking to your neighbors, dispelling any myths, having a discussion. If it doesn't go well, well, ask yourself, do I want to keep bees so badly that I'm going to ruin relationships with my neighbors? And hopefully you make the decision of let's not go there.
Right.
And then take that route, find somewhere else. Almost everybody knows somebody who has agriculturally zoned land or has the ability to put it somewhere, university or school or wherever, that somebody's really wanting bees but would like a beekeeper to come in, and seek out those relationships if it's not going to work with your neighbors, because we'd really kind of frown upon people taking their agricultural stand in the beekeeping world. I say, pick something else, please, because we don't need that kind of issue.
No kidding. We haven't yet talked about honey. And of course, that's also part of this, of course, for the typical beekeeper. How tricky is it to do actually the harvesting of the honey? Is that a relatively simple matter? Is it you just sort of pour it in a jar? Or is there more involved to getting delicious honey that people are going to want to purchase and consume?
Well, you need a good space to harvest your honey. I've gotten into honey production, and we go to Kenosha Harbor Market, and we enjoy selling honey and interacting with people. We're very blessed in this part of the country. Northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin has some of the best honey in the country. It's very light flavored and very award-winning honey. So you do need equipment to do it efficiently, what we call an extractor. It's like a centrifuge that where you take the frames, if you're using a Longstroth hive, you take the frames out, and if the honey's ripened, if the bees have the honey appropriately ripened and at the appropriate moisture level, then you put that in your extractor, take it out, maybe lightly strain it, or and then put it in your jars.
And there you go.
And it's absolutely and another great point to mention, if people did want to join our club, one of the benefits is we have a number of extractors, which are a very expensive piece of equipment that the club members can rotate. So part of your $5 annual membership gives you access to pick up the hive from the extractor from whomever has it at the time, and then use it and then have it be cleaned and ready for the next user. If people wanted to find out more about our club, the website is rkbeekeepers.org, and that'd be a great place to find out about our meetings and such. And so the extractor in the Langstroth system is how you get the honey out. In the top bar system that I do, you have to cut the comb out, and it's called crush and strain. And so there's less honey typically in a top bar system, but a little more wax. Hmm. A lot of people like beeswax, make candles and different lotions and lip balms. It's also great if you have old wood furniture that has the old wood-on-wood sliding drawers. Mm. Use it for lubrication, soap making, lots of different concepts. So, yeah. So even when it comes to the simple concept of harvesting your honey, there's multiple flavors out there on how that actually occurs.
Hmm. Before we finish up, Peter, I should give you a minute or two to just talk about a little mishap that you happened to have earlier today as we are recording this interview. I understand you got a phone call and evidently some leftover tree damage from one of our recent storms chose today to fall down right on top of your hives. What kind of damage was done?
Yes, I did receive a call, and I had to quickly run over to my hives, pick up a chainsaw, and a couple trees came down and smashed one of my hives, not entirely, so it was salvageable. And so the bees weren't very excited, happy. They were definitely excited.
Yeah, right.
And I had to screw the pieces back together, and I was able to, for the most part, salvage that hive. But I had these large trees hanging over, and I had to slowly trim away. They were resting kind of on my hive, a big hive stand, and they were resting on there. So it was a little bit of a process to relieve the pressure of the trees resting on there, because if they went a little further, they were going to take out the rest of my hives. So so when you fantasize about being a beekeeper, these are some things that really just don't pop into your mind.
Right.
Only good thoughts of tasty honey seem to come along.
Absolutely.
And the stings and the mishaps and the windstorms that blow things over just aren't something that you think of, but they're definitely things that occur.
Right. Well, wouldn't life be dull without such unexpected occurrences? Well, we're glad it wasn't worse than it was, and glad you were able to kind of get home and patch things together and try to make your bees happy again. So let's leave our listeners with some important information, namely what they should do if they would like to find out more information about the Racine Kenosha Beekeepers Association, especially ahead of your next meeting, which is coming up on the 2nd of September. What should they do?
They could simply go to rkbeekeepers.org. There they would find the address of where we hold our meetings there at 45 and 50. And they also could go there if they couldn't make the 2nd, say, and they could see our calendar for when our next meetings are. And once in a while, we do hold the meeting at an alternate location if there's some kind of a scheduling conflict or any other reason. So they should really check our website, see where the next meeting is, and all they need to do is just show up. They'll come through the door. They'll meet up with our wonderful secretary, Cheryl Miracle, and she will check them in, take their $5, make a little name tag that'll go right on their shirt. They'll sit down. We'll start the meeting. We'll say, is there any new beekeepers or interested beekeepers in the room? This person would then raise their hand, and we would ask them to introduce themselves and see if we couldn't connect them with a beekeeping mentor, and we would go on with our outline for that evening on what we were going to discuss, and then there's always general open discussion. It's a very open, informal, many answers to one question. We give everybody a chance, because there's one thing you can say about beekeepers is if you ask 10 beekeepers the same question, you probably get like 20 different answers because there's so many different ways to go about things.
Sure.
So.
Well, that makes it all the richer in experience, and I think you've really shown a light on that very effectively. Both of you have. Peter Poley is current president, Tim Fulton, past president of the Racine Kenosha Beekeepers Association. I so appreciate both of you joining us today on the morning show. This has really been interesting. I feel like I learned a lot, and I know many of our listeners did as well. And we hope this will generate even some further interest in this really important undertaking of raising more bees for this beautiful planet of ours. So thank you again to both of you for joining us today on the morning show.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Gregory Berg.